Hi, this is Amy, and in this episode, AADL talks to Hiawatha Bailey. Hiawatha grew up in the Ann Arbor area and lived in the legendary Hill Street houses, where he became a member of the Trans Love Energy Commune, later the White Panther Party, then the Rainbow People's Party. In the 1970s and 80s, he was a roadie for the Detroit band Destroy All Monsters and formed his own punk band, Cult Heroes. In this episode, Hiawatha talks about his political awakening and local activism during Ann Arbor's countercultural heyday in the 1960s. He also shares stories of living and working at the Hill Street Commune and his lifelong love affair with music. Well, thanks so much, Hiawatha, for agreeing to chat with me today.
No problem.
You came, well, I understand you came from Georgia to Hamtramck, and you also went to Catholic school, and then you moved to Belleville. You've had a wide variety of environments and influences growing up. Can you talk about how they influenced you as a kid and then a teen?
Sure. I was born at home in Columbus, Georgia, along with my sister Gwendolyn, and my dad didn't want to raise a family down south with, across the Mason-Dixon line with all the racism that was going on down there. So I actually turned 1 year old when we moved to Hamtramck. I went to Friendship Nursery School, Kosciuszko Elementary School, and kind of hard.
My name is Hiawatha. What school do you go to? I go to Kosciuszko. Where do you live at? Hamtramck.
And then from Hamtramck, my dad got a job working at Chevrolet Gear and Axle. And we moved from Hamtramck to the east side of Detroit. And back then, Detroit, the community that where we lived in Detroit was Buick and Mack Avenue. And it was like a diversified community. There were Chaldeans next door, Catholic families, Baptist people. And you could get your butt whooped at the neighbor's house on one corner and all the way down the street until you got home for whatever you did. Point being, people were taking care of their kids in the neighborhood. Then prior to the Detroit riots, sometime prior to that, my dad decided I was starting to get a little rambunctious. And he told me, on his way to work, he goes, I'm going to give you three choices. And you decide by the time I get home, either up north where my uncle was the head of the juvenile branch of the police department, and later on became mayor, Joe Louis Stevenson, or military school, or the country. And I fretted and fretted, and I thought, oh my goodness, I don't want to go to Saginaw. Definitely don't want to go to military school. I said, the country, that sounds like fun. Whitewashing picket fences, Tom Sawyer. Thinking about all that garbage. Nobody told me. No streetlights. Mosquitoes the size of dive bombers. Snakes. But I did choose the country, and we wound up getting a piece of property out in Belleville, Sumter Township. My aunt lived down the road from us in my grandfather's house, my aunt, brother, aunt's house, and our house across the street from the First Missionary Baptist Church, where I became president of the junior choir.
Ah. So music at an early age, huh?
Well, yeah. Actually, back then, it wasn't that my voice was all that. It was that we lived across the road from the church, and my mom had the key to the church, so choir rehearsals were on Thursdays. And as being a member of the junior choir, I got the key, and I got to open the door to the church. I thought it was because of my voice, but no. But that started things,
Now, did you come into Ann Arbor and did you hang out here much at that time?
Back then, no, not yet. I was still like in elementary school. But slowly but surely, you know, the 60s, the draft, and I joined Washtenaw Community College during its first year. As an attempt to avoid the draft, I wanted the student deferment of 2S to avoid getting. I didn't know anything about Vietnam. And when I was in high school, a couple of friends dropped out and joined the military and wound up coming back in boxes, you know. And I thought, this war, man, I don't know anything about that. So though earlier on, I thought about joining the Air Force. But that was before the war, and, you know. They put a whole different palette on things, you know? So, I wound up going to Washtenaw. I had a 2S student deferment. And I had a 4-hour oil painting course taught by, Bianca McClatchy. And one of my fellow students was Steve Carell from the Rationals.
Huh.
And so I started going to, you know, he would come in dressed like, you know, the lead singer of or guitar player in the Rationals. And I thought, this guy seems really cool. So I started going to check those guys out slowly but surely. That introduced me to the alternative underground culture in Ann Arbor. Sunday concerts and White Panther Party was then called Trans Love Energy. And the MC5 and the Up and Dudes. And I'm like, wow, man, this is a lot cooler than Vietnam, if you ask me.
So what age were you when you met John Sinclair and when you moved into the commune over there on Hill Street? How old were you?
When I was at Washington, I was like 18, of course. Mm-hmm. I just graduated. And so I would have been, I'm not good with numbers, but I probably would have been, you know, like 20, 21, something like that. And before moving in, I ran into a bunch of, you know, we used to go to the Sunday concerts and listen to the band play. And these friends of mine had this house over on Felt Street. We found out later that Diana Hutt and some of the people from the Rim 3 of the Weathermen who were living there at that time. But then friends, brothers and sisters of theirs moved in and took over the house. And I started hanging out with those guys. And we heard about the White Panthers, who were the Rainbow People. Wait a minute. Trans Love Energies back then. It's from the town. Then there was this guy named Panther White, and he was going around town putting up these flyers saying Panther White is running. He was running for city council, and I was thinking Panther White. I was thinking it had something to do with Ku Klux Klan or something weird. I was, you know, part of that whole that whole development back then was smoking pot and dropping my first hit of LSD. So we were all running around in the Arboretum and being little stoned hippies. And we kept seeing these flyers all over town saying, Panther White is running. We thought it had something to do, as I said, with like some racist group. But it turned out he was a self-appointed minister of Zinta in the White Panther Party, or what was then Trans Love Energy. And he would announce the MC5 before they play. This is Panther White. You're about to have a cultural experience, blah, 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 blah. Well, we finally found out it was really cool, and I used to sneak over to the houses and hide in the backyard, trying to figure out exactly what those guys were up to. And there would be all of the girls that were groupies for the MC5. They had a sewing room off the back porch, and they would be making all of the band's outfits. for days. And I went back to Sunny Good Street, which is the county we lived at 1513 South University. And I said, hey, these guys are pretty cool. You guys got to check it out. Well, the Ann Arbor riots happened a little while after that. And that was after the Detroit riot. And we all decided we were going to go down to South University and take over the street. Well, the Ann Arbor police and Doug Harvey, Sheriff Harvey of the Washtenaw County Police, they had a whole different plan for us. And, well, we wound up getting beat back from South University. We took over the streets for 3 days. And every night after we got done with what we call the riot, we would clean up the street, clean up after ourselves, pick up everything, and go home. Well, word spread. People were driving in from the suburbs. On the third day, the city council had had enough of that. They called the National Guard in, and the National Guard were, like, policing South University. I thought, wow, this is pretty weird. Well, a little while after that, John had been arrested prior to that, before the party moved to Ann Arbor. And Dave Sinclair, his brother, came over to our commune and said, you know, you guys are pretty cool, but don't you realize that there's something going on, you know, something happening in the streets? You know, and in order for us to get John out of jail, we have to build a strong local base. And I know that you know everybody in town, and you're well connected with the underground movement here. And why don't you think about politics and getting involved on a political level instead of just walking around smoking dope and tripping out? You guys got to think about the political relevancy of what you're doing, of our culture. We talked about it. Next thing I knew, me and my whole house moved into the White Panther house. There was like 12 of us, and we moved in on the third floor. We called it the psychedelic, White Panther psychedelic barracks. And we proceeded to start working to get John out of jail as the marijuana laws being cruel and unjust.
So you wouldn't have called yourself a political activist prior to that point? So it was David Sinclair that really kind of sparked that interest. Is that what I'm hearing?
Totally, totally, Dave. You know, back then we were just all tripping and having fun, and it was like anything to avoid the war, you know? And the factory, I was also working at Ford Motor Company at the time, the Rosendale plant. Just none of that. Nobody told me about all that stuff when I was growing up. But when I got hanging out in Ann Arbor, there was like music and incense and marijuana, no underwear. So, yeah. And but what Dave said was true. And I started to realize in a political aspect of our lifestyle. And the fact that John had been arrested for 9.5 to 10 years for possession of 2 joints of marijuana, we knew that wasn't right. So we started working. Trans Love Energy, instead of being a commune of musicians and artists and groupies, went out to California to the Peace and Freedom Conference that the Black Panther Party put on, and came back politicized and decided to become the White Panther Party, a fraternal organization based on the tenets of the Black Panther Party. We established a 10-point program that emulated their 10-point program, but dealt with our own community needs. Like free food, free shelter, free clothing. One of our statements was free everything for everyone, which was in our idealistic, we were kids, in our idealistic manner. We thought we could really do that. We got pretty close, actually. Started the People's Food Co-op, and for $7, you could get the equivalent of $30 worth of groceries. But we had to load our equipment trucks, drive into farmers market in Detroit after collecting money from the various communes in town. And like I said, for about $10 or $15. We could get like almost $50 worth of groceries. Bring them back to the houses, bag them up, and people that had, you know, given us initial money to go shop would come and pick up their groceries. That was one of the things we did. We started the community, Children's Community Center, the CCC, where instead of, you know, putting our kids in daycare, members of the house would take turns doing kid duty. And we would babysit the various convicts and down kids. There'd be sometimes like, I don't know, up to 10 kids that, you know, have to take care of. Never forget tripping on acid once. Kids love me because I'd hang out with them and play with them and stuff. And their parents would pick them up after when it was time to. And this one day I'd say, okay, kids, it's time to get dressed. Your parents are coming to get you. They made picket signs, circled me with these picket signs they had made. And they were staging their own revolution. They were not their parents. We won't get drunk. We're not going home. This is the revolution. Come and get your rugrat, please. But, you know, we were doing things like that to help ourselves. We had needs that weren't being met by the overview. So we formed committees and organized ourselves to deal with our own needs. And that was the politicization of Trans Love Energy into the White Panther Party.
Yeah. So what else did you do in the house? Like, what else? You mentioned, you know, babysitting duties. You mentioned that people would sew. And what was it like in the house? What was the atmosphere like? We've interviewed a bunch of other folks, Pun Plamondon, Jeannie, Gary Grimshaw, Lenny Sinclair. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with some of them and some of the other things that happened in the house?
Oh, we loved them. The Central Committee was responsible for just perusing the environment and looking at things that needed to be done and making plans to have those things done. And we and the general cadre, as we referred to, would implement the Central Committee's directives out in the town. You know, we had the Sun newspaper. We had, like I said, the Children's Community Center, the food co-op. There were a lot of things that we were doing. And plus, we lived in those three houses. And there was like three houses worth of us, and that took a lot of organizing too. And you know, I sometimes think back and try and figure out how we did it. But one of the things I loved office duty, where I was, you know, the front office. There were always people coming and going. So, officer of the day, you would sit at the front desk. People would either call or come in, and you'd ask them what they needed. And direct them, you know, if they came to hang out with the band, direct them to the rehearsal space. Or if they needed to meet with the chief of staff, who was Dave Sinclair, you address them there. Or Gene Pun, who was Minister of Defense, you know. So we were pretty, we were well organized, actually. And all of that was organizing to get the word out, to spread the word, and neutralize the negativity in town about the White Panther Party. Cause a lot of, you know, there were a lot of college students that had dropped out of college and started riding, you know, the SDS, and those people were getting going. And they were always a little standoffish with us. So it took a while for them to understand that we were all fighting the same fight, just from different angles. And part of that was allowing them to come to the houses and see how we lived and what we were doing. Those weather people were kind of weird. They were always talking about blowing stuff up, and, you know.
Yeah, did you hang out with them? Did they come over there and hang out with y'all?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Actually, yeah. Yippee, Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, Jane Fonda, Timothy Leary, And on the music trip, there were a lot of blues and jazz musicians that were familiar with John and hanging out with him at the artist workshop when it was in Detroit. And they would come and stay at the houses with us, Sun Ra, Archie Shepp, Dr. John, Jefferson Airplane. The list goes on and on.
Yeah. So I know that in the with the John Sinclair Freedom Rally, I know that you were on the receiving end of a phone call from Yoko Ono. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. You know, it was when we started putting together the lineup for the Free John Now Rally at Chrysler Arena. Pete Andrews worked for Daystar and was really instrumental in hooking us up with the University Activities Committee. So we made this plan for the Free John Now Rally, and we were going to bring everybody together, all of us in support of John, and hold this event at Chrysler Arena, which had just gotten built, and this was one of the first events that actually occurred here. And a lot of people were coming to the houses. It was actually this, I remember I was sitting there one day, and this guy comes to the door, and he knocks, and I go, can I help you? And he goes, you know, you read something about free drugs and free sex and free John. And, you know, well, bring me the hemlock like they did Socrates, he says. I go running upstairs. I go, Dave, there's this wackadoodle on the porch. He's talking about hemlock and Socrates. But, you know, because the word had gotten out about, well, we put the word out about the Freedom Rally, we were getting all of the energy input, you know. People who were supportive and not as that guy was, but I was sitting there. I had office duty. We're all sitting there smoking joints. I'm answering the phone. And the phone rings, and I answer the white panther headquarters, national headquarters. How may I help you?
This is Yoko Ono. I would like to speak to Dave Sinclair.
God, it was just some other jerk. Yeah, well, this is, I don't know what I said to her, but I hung up and lit another joint. And we were passing a joint, and Gary goes, who's that? I said, I don't know. Somebody. The phone rings back, and I said, hello. Hi, this is John Lennon, and I'd like to speak to Dave Sinclair. And I wasn't even that hip to the Beatles back then, because I was doing this psychedelic rock and stuff, but I knew who the Beatles were. But somehow I knew that was John Lennon. I go running upstairs. I go, Dave, I think John Lennon's on the phone. And that was John calling to volunteer Ian Yoko's help and at the Freedom Rally to get John out.
That's great you didn't hang up that second time.
I know. And then the night of the Freedom Rally, I mean, there was so much going on, you know, and I was always tripping my butt off. I'm tripping my brain, and I decided to go out and sit in the stadium through the tunnel there, and football players going, oh, I just needed a break. So I go out and I'm sitting, and I'm thinking, boy, we really did it. I don't know if it's going to work, but we should. And all of a sudden, the wind blows up, picks up a bunch of litter, blows it around the seat, and it stops right next to me. And I thought, okay, I'm going back in now. I get up, start walking through the tunnel. It's like I'm about to go in, this limo pulls up, and it was John and Yoko. And I mean, the fervor of people. That here was like hundreds of people just pounding on the seat. John asked me to help him, get him out of the limo, get him into the dressing room, push the door shut. People are pushing like Beatles albums and trying to get signatures and are trying to get autographs and stuff. And I'm like, holy Christ, this is really happening. She gets the door shut. And John goes, hey, mate, you look like I can't do an English accent.
But he goes, hey, you look like somebody I can trust. Here, do some of this while I teach Yoko the chords to this song. And he hands me this vial of coke. And I'm like, wow. So I actually honked with John Lennon while he taught Yoko the chords to that stupid song that she performed. The stairs, ooh, the stairs, ooh, it is. You know, Yoko.
I know that I'm curious about your relationship with music. I know that Sinclair was really very much into blues and jazz. Were you interested in blues and jazz, or talk about your influences?
Well, when I joined the party, I was also the roadie for the Up. When the MC got signed, the central committee had a meeting with them, and I was there, and they tried to talk the band into the band that got assigned to Elektra Records, and the central committee was trying to talk to them into being more supportive and helping us get the word out about John, who was their manager and got them their contract in the first place. But a couple of the members, like Wayne in particular, didn't want to have anything to do with it. The reason why we had to change record label was because of our affiliation with the politics of the party. And, you know, so they turned their back on John, as we thought. But I was working with the Up. When the MC5 got signed, they just left, and the Up became the musical organ for the White Panther Party. And wherever bands played at, we would go. Jeannie P, our Minister of Communications, would speak about John's cause. And then the band would play. And we would circulate petitions to get John's case, you know, to inform people about John's situation and to get signatures on these petitions, the hemp petitions, help end marijuana prohibition. And so I was working with the Up at that time. So I was always involved in music. And like I said, we had like Archie Shepp and Ornette Coleman, and all these people would come and stay like 2 or 3 days at the house while they were playing in Detroit or wherever they were playing at. And so music was always there, you know, and I worked with the Up all the time that I was here, and we did our touring and stuff. You know, we at the Freedom Rally, actually, we got a phone call from John, and the state of Michigan had put a referendum on the ballot. And that was weird too. I forget about that. The state house was, you know, having debates on the marijuana law. It's being cruel and unjust punishment. So we figured, hey, you know, those guys, if they just smoked a joint, they realize nobody should be in jail for 9.5 to 10 years for smoking a joint. And so we had our White Panther chapter at Wayne State got a bunch of envelopes, and we did this printout that had a Art Crum diagram of how to smoke a joint. The roller joint, how to smoke it. And then we had this Colombian red bud. So we rolled up 2 joints and put it in all of these envelopes and with that cartoon and sent it to the House of Representatives with this little letter that said, hey, you know, listen, this is what they have locked this man up, our chairman up, for 9.5 to 10 years for. You're home by yourself or sitting in your office or the kids are at school. No, here. You don't have to go underground or become a criminal in order to access it. Here, all you got to do is light this up, take a toke off of it, and see if you feel like you need to be locked up for 9.5 to 10 years.
Did it work?
Well, a lot of people turned in the joint, but a lot of them didn't. And a referendum was actually put on the ballot, and the people of the state of Michigan voted and overturned the marijuana laws as being cruel and unjust punishment. And in Ann Arbor, we had established the $5 pipeline too, as part of our work. So, you know, the precursor to changing the pot laws was established in Ann Arbor with the $5 ordinance for marijuana.
Yeah, and that's certainly come a long way since then, hasn't it?
What sure is. You know, I walk through my town and it's like being in a different country.
Now, you were quoted as saying that working with the White Panthers was a precursor of the do-it-yourself ethic of punk rock. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because you eventually moved in that direction as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, what I meant, I don't know exactly what I meant, but I think what I meant was like, you know, nobody was taking care of our kids. Nobody was giving us the portable food. Nobody was dealing with our political needs. We were dealing with our own stuff. We had issues, and since nobody was dealing with them, and we had to figure out ways to deal with our own problems on our own. And that ethic is the same in punk rock. You know, I would go around when I started the band in 1978. We had like 8 songs. And I thought, well, in order to make it, you got to play New York. So with our 8 songs, me and my drummer got in a quarterly, drove to New York, and booked our first show in New York at CBGB's with 8 songs. After that, I had opened up for Ron Ashton's band from the Stooges of the Destroy of Monsters, and we played the Hamburg Pub. That was our first show. And I'll never forget, we pull in, and the marquee said, "Performing tonight, Destroy All Monsters and the Occult Heroes." It take the OC off of there. It's Cult Heroes. Oh, we go on. We play our 8 tunes. And Ron goes, that was our first show. And I said, "Hey, Ronnie," because I respect him, the Stooges, so much. I said, "What do you think of my band?" He goes, "Well, I actually... guys were impressed with," he goes, I expected you guys to suck, but you didn't. And what are you gonna do for your next set?" And I went, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, you gotta play 2 sets. You're opening up for us. We only got 1 set, you gotta play it." I go, "Ryan, we only know 8 songs." He goes, "Well, you gotta do something." So I wrote the set list backwards. So we went on, and what was our last tune? Because by the time we made it through the whole set on the first set, we were hitting on our cylinder. So, second set, we started with what was the last tune, and we were hitting on all cylinders when we started the second set. Then after that, it was off to the races. The next show, or not the next show, but that was when I decided we had to go to New York. We got to play New York if you're going to punk rock. Went in, met with Hilly Crystal. He taught me how to defend myself while we were playing a cassette of our music. He goes, "Oh, you're from Detroit. You guys in Detroit think you're pretty cool. This is New York and blah, blah, blah." Stage manager kept going, "Hilly, they want to know about a gig. They came here to book a gig." He goes, "No, I'm trying to teach them that New York is rougher than Detroit." He goes, "Come on, rush me like you're going to mug me on a subway." He sees me rush him and he does this judo move and flips me around and stuff, and he goes, "See, Detroit ain't that tough." And he looks at Jeff, his manager, and book him this weekend. So we got a weekend gig at CBGB, like 1981, 78, just back around in there.
Wow.
And that started us on the way.
So how many songs have you written altogether?
Oh, God, the songbook is voluminous, you know? I mean, that was, like I said, in 1978. And other than covers of songs that people need to be reminded of, you know, like MC5 covers and Stooges covers, all our stuff is original. So,
a lot. So did you hang on to your political views? I know that at one time you called yourself a Marxist-Leninist dialectical materialist. Did that change?
Yeah.
You still that?
No. Yes, in a manner of speaking, yeah, because I don't know, you know, like Marxism with all the weird stuff going on with China and Trump and all that garbage now, you know. But the Red Book was our Bible. Chairman Mao's Red Book, the little Red Book. So, you know, we needed a foundation from somewhere. And we, the White Panther Party, Rainbow People's Party, kind of emulated a lot of the teachings of Chairman Mao Zedong. So that was where that dialectical materialist came, you know, that was where that came from. I was always telling people, you know, everybody's always approaching me about the White Panther Party and me being the only black member of SED. And it's not about the color. It's about the politics. It's not about my race. It's about the ethics of our political ideology. So we tried to transition, or we did transition to the Rainbow People's Party. And our newspaper, The Sun, transitioned into Sign Dance because it, and the rainbow, because it represented the unification of all colors, united. And we got Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and those people from the Yippies to come because they were the Youth International Party, and that's what we wanted to do initially, was unite all youth together to fight for our own cause. Jerry was like egocentric. Abby was cool, but Jerry just didn't want to have anything to do with our radicalism. You know, he wanted he was more of an anarchist than a revolutionary. And he thought that uniting with the Youth International, with the Yippies, would bring too much radicalism in politics. And what they, you know, they were going around throwing bombs at things and doing dumb stuff with no plan. You know, we had the legal self-defense fund. If people got arrested at our event, we had money collected that could help bail them out of jail. Jerry was just going around in an anarchistic fashion, you know, entrancing people to do things. And it was all like guerrilla theater, acting out, when you know, and if something were to happen, those guys would just be gone, you know. So, then the referendum, I talked about that, bylaw change, eventually got John out of jail. And once John got out, he, you know, he had gone through so much. I understand it, you know, but he just didn't want to have anything to do with politics the way we had stopped organized, you know. And he started managing a bunch of bands like Mitch Ryder and some of the other jazz bands that he used to work with when he was at the artist workshop, and set us all down and said, well, you guys, I've decided I'm going to dissolve the party. And we all look at each other and go, what? We're ready to keep going. What do you mean? And he goes, well, he looks at me and goes, well, because 10 for 2, John Lennon and Yoko Ono had a film company called Joko Film. And they filmed the Freedom Rally. You should check that out sometime. And I'm in it, you know, on stage, hauling equipment and setting up bands. Then afterwards, when John was being released, I took his daughter, Sunny, and handed her to him as the news cameras were flashing. Then John hands me his wedding ring and goes, those motherfuckers, I even took my wedding ring. So I took the poverty band off of his wedding ring and slipped it back on his finger. And he grabs his daughter and Lenny, his wife. They embrace. And somebody goes, hey, John, now that you've changed the pot laws in the state, what's next? And somebody said, smoke dope. And we all turn and look in the direction of the voice and freeze frame, and the credits for the movie roll. So that's when John said, well, you made it into the movies. Now hide.
next. Dissolving the party. And I'm like, yeah. Well, what was next? Was lining up, going back to the community. Had no options for economics other than going back to swinging pot and LSD. And wound up getting busted and sent to Lexington, the Federal Correctional Institute. Gene Blaze, the Billy Holiday, and Gene Krupa were locked up in the 50s and 40s under the NARA Act, the Narcotics Addiction Rehabilitation Act. And that was actually where I decided to form the band or become a musician.
Yeah, I know you met Michael Davis and Wayne Kramer there, right?
Sure did. Me and Mike were in this one unit. It was like being locked up on the diet, you know. These great buildings that were built during the Reformation in the 50s. Beautiful facility. We had golf courts, horseback riding, you know, our own theater. I became the editor of the newspaper. Michael had his own art studio, where he would be down the hall for me painting, and I'd be across the way publishing Flack, the publication, publication, and just biding our time. But parole board, you get to go before the parole board, and one would have to declare themselves. Under the NARA Act, the Narcotics Addiction and Rehabilitation Act, the statute of limitations for my charge were less time than if I declare myself an addict, I would do less time. And I said, I'm not addicted. I know what I'm doing, and I'm not under the ravages of drugs. I'm a dialectical materialist Marxist, and my rant, which they had be there. Mike actually got out earlier than I did in the Wayne because they declared themselves addicts.
So do you think that if John hadn't changed directions, if the party had continued to pursue all of the social and community activism that they had been doing, that you would have maybe stayed out of the FCI in Lexington, that you would have maybe not sold drugs? Is that what?
Well, I can't blame them for that. But, you know, once the party dissolved, there was, you know, in terms of, I mean, when we were in the White Panther Party, there was all of us. And we had three houses, and we had an organization. But upon dissolution, you know, it was like, oh, boy, now I got all this attention. I mean, Nixon had a directive. He said to J. Edgar Hoover, who was probably changing his stockings at the time, and said, I want something done about those people up there in Ann Arbor at 1510, 1520, and 1522 Hills. And that was the directive from the Oval Office, from the White House, sent to J. Edgar Hoover. So, I mean.
So they were watching.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
Freedom of Information Act deleted. You know, yeah, they were watching us big time. I mean, we were using the law to change the law, and they did not like that. Then, writing on out of this, the creative life of a musician in comparison to revolutionary life, you're both the same. Using what you have to get what you want or what you need. You know? You were asking about the changes in Ann Arbor in the last 6 years. I was in town a couple of nights ago, and it's like, you know, they can't, the plague of the university, you can't spread out anymore because the footprint is so large. Now it's up everywhere. There used to be a commune. They just tore down Broncourt.
Yeah.
It was like one of the last holdouts. Town is changing, you know. Most of the artists are moving to Ypsilanti, which is where I live now, because you can't afford, you know, the per capita in Ann Arbor is not designed for us. But Ypsi's not that far away, so.
Well, what are you most proud of over the course of your career?
That I kept the faith. That time and changes haven't changed me. I can't change time. Spring's fascination fascinating me. I'm just going through the changes, and I'm proud to be me.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much, Hiawatha.
God bless you, Amy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
AADL Talks To is a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.